A writer like Margaret Earhart knows how the land that surrounds you can shape the stories you tell. A few years back, she wrote a mystery novel called The Butterflies of Grand Canyon. It's set in 1950s small-town Flagstaff, Arizona. The red dirt on Margaret's shoes is evidence of her work as a trail and river guide in the canyon. She's taught creative writing on the Navajo and Hopi reservations and even worked as a local firefighter. Margaret joins us from Flagstaff for a closer look at one of America's best-loved places.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Now, what an interesting combination. You're a guide in the Grand Canyon, and you've written this romantic mystery novel. Tell us how that works together, appreciation of nature and being a novelist.
Well, I think novelists have to be great observers. I actually have had very little science training, so I came to the Grand Canyon recently to see it in a way that was different from the way I had been seeing it for the last 30 years. I came looking at the bugs and looking at the flora as well and the animals, and that has proved so fascinating to me. My experience there was so much richer.
Because you looked at the bugs. Now, how can that be?
Well, have you ever looked at bugs, Rick?
Actually, I have. A highlight of my Costa Rica trip was called the Nocturnal Bug Walk, and we walked down a path that you would just not even give two looks at during the daytime. And at night, it was a wonderland of fascinating bugs. Is there something similar going on in the Grand Canyon?
Yes, although it doesn't just happen at night. It's just that we miss so much in our daily lives. We miss so much by not looking closely. And I think novelists, our assignment is to look closely.
Now, your book is set in the 1950s, and it has more to do with people than bugs, doesn't it?
Well, people who are quite passionate about bugs, yes. I set my book in the 50s for no reason that I could figure out until it was halfway written. And then I realized that was a time in the national parks in general when we were moving from sort of Renaissance men at the head of the parks to a more law and order type of culture there. I had to include myself in this book, and only partially, of course, am I Jane Merkel, our heroine. She arrives from Points East, and she's very young at the time, which I am not. And she falls in love with Grand Canyon. And of course, you know, she falls in love with the representatives of Grand Canyon, a handsome young ranger. And also she falls in love with catching butterflies. The book has many historical characters in it, which was one of the most fun parts for me to write. I wanted to honor some of the people who, at least in my part of the world, Flagstaff, Arizona, are so infamous and famous, and to put them in a novel was really quite extraordinarily fun for me.
Margaret, could you read a few paragraphs of your book just to give us an insight into its style and what you'd like us to understand about the book?
Yeah, Rick, I'd like to read to you and your listeners a few paragraphs that have to do with Jane Merkel, that's our heroine, her first sight of the Grand Canyon in daylight. And this might give people an idea of what the canyon looks like. It turns out that it's very difficult to describe Grand Canyon, and I hope I've done it justice. But you must come see it. That's really the way you see it. So Jane is driving along the rim with her in-laws, and this is how the piece goes. Jane feels carsick, but interested, and peeks out across the vast space, bluish with haze. It is the first real look she's allowed herself, her first sight of the canyon in daylight. It's wider than she thought it would be. Somehow she imagined a slice, a sharp cut in the earth. But this is a ragged opening, full of what her in-laws call temples, great vertical slabs of rock, flat-topped mountains, some of them tree-covered, others bare, rising up like islands in a dry sea. And everywhere a great convolution of folded land, everywhere the spidery dry pathways of water etching their way downward in dark lines. If she half closes her eyes, she can see a great blue cloth, a heavy linen cloth folded upon itself in the blue haze, a lover's dress, a lover's cape flung to the floor, and the sky a blade of blue above it all, and the snow shining on the northern shore. Of course it's a rim, but to her it's a shore. The far shore of a river of air and light, suspended in space, suspended in spaciousness, for goodness sake. Not one bit like the river she grew up with, the muddy, shrieking, crowded, busy, bustling, big-shouldered, stevedored, hot, steamy, frozen, churning, legendary Mississippi. No, nothing like that. Suddenly, it's all too much for her. The grandness, the majesty, the sheer size, the arousing sense of all that rock, sinuous rock. Oh, it's too much. It overwhelms her as thoughts of death do, or the universe, which has no end anywhere, no edge. She closes her eyes and hears Oliver Hedquist say, 10 years of looking out at that miracle, and still I never see it to my satisfaction. Do you, Dottie? Now, wow. Dottie and Oliver are the couple she's gone to visit.
Yeah. You sound almost evangelical about getting people to appreciate the Grand Canyon.
Well, I suppose you've got a point there. I just find it to be such a marvel. And the more I go there, the more I find it to be a marvel, which is not true for every place. I think that's about looking more closely every time.
Now, there's a fair amount of sex in your book. Do you find the Grand Canyon erotic?
Yes. Yes, I do.
I was surprised at that. When I read it, there's a sort of an eroticism about describing it.
Oh, yes. Well, I think if anybody actually puts themselves at the rim of the Grand Canyon and looks down into it and feels the heat if they're going in summer and just lets their gaze drift out at all the colors and land formations. And as I've tried to describe in that passage, it is just it is a very sexy place, come to think of it. I'm glad you brought that up, Rick.
You inhale it. I mean, you inhale it and you hold it in.
Yeah, yeah. It could be also because there's always that wandering river down at the bottom, which you can see sometimes from some vantage points and not see from others. And you know the river has done a great deal of the carving, though not all, the carving of the Grand Canyon, and yet it's hidden. It's a mystery. It's like the unconscious almost.
It dares you to go in.
Yeah.
Now, you're a guide, and you take people in. What's your greatest delight as a guide when it comes to sharing the wonders of the Grand Canyon?
I like it when people enjoy the food I make, but my greatest delight really, of course, is when I can take them to a place they wouldn't have gone to themselves, which they didn't know about, which may not be in the guidebooks, and they stand in front of it, usually some kind of waterfall, because there's a lot of water in Grand Canyon, even though we are in a desert, and the water maybe hits the light, and then it hits them, and they are speechless. Those are the great, great, great moments.
That requires being still and being observant to observe how the light hits the water, something that some people need to be encouraged to do, I would imagine.
I think you slow down. The minute you get below the rim, I really believe you slow down. At least within the first 2 hours, almost everybody who's coming with me, everybody settles down.
As a guide, I think it's important for you to actually enable people to do that.
Yeah, and I'm helped so much by the place. I really have to do very little. It's not a hard place to work as a guide because the place runs the show.
That's great.
People become very, very still. They become much more observant. Mm-hmm. As much as they think they appreciate it going in, they almost always really understand what that appreciation means when they're in there for a day.
Margaret Earhart's taken us into Grand Canyon on Travel with Rick Steves. It inspired her novel, The Butterflies of Grand Canyon. Margaret won the Milkweed National Fiction Prize for her book Crossing Bully Creek, set in the Deep South of the late 1960s. Her website is margaretearhart.com. That's E-R-H-A-R-T. Mark's on the line at 877-333-RICK from Tempe in Arizona. Thanks for calling, Mark.
Hey, you're welcome. I enjoyed just listening to her description, and I would absolutely agree with her that there's just no good way to describe the canyon. And I've tried to photograph it, and there's just no way to describe it to people. It's something that you really have to experience.
Mark, have you experienced the Grand Canyon recently?
Last time I was down was last year.
That's fairly recent in geologic time.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely, especially when you think about the Grand Canyon.
Well, Mark, there's a lot of ways you can better appreciate the Grand Canyon, being quiet, being still, looking at the bugs. What would your tip be?
I think my best tip is being quiet, watching the wildlife with your feet in one of the streams after you've hiked about 10 miles.
Nice, I can relate to that. Oh, man, I think in any canyon, put your foot in the stream and watch the wildlife. That's a nice way to punctuate your hike.
Exactly.
All right. Mark, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Maria's on the line in Lewiston, New York. Maria, thanks for your call.
You're welcome. My husband and I are preparing a trip to the Grand Canyon. And I heard that they organize rides on horseback and on donkeys along the canyon. And I would like to know if they are by any chance dangerous or not advised for someone like me who has a vertigo, because I have no doubt in riding a donkey or a horse, but if the donkey goes along a very narrow pass very close to the canyon, I wonder if I wouldn't feel afraid.
I wonder the same thing myself.
Yeah, well, Maria, my advice to you is to stay off. They're actually mules, and in some parts of the canyon, they're horses. The mules are very sturdy animals, but vertigo is not the right thing to bring into Grand Canyon, because everywhere you look, there's great drop-offs. I think you might feel sturdier on your own two feet just walking down a little bit of a ways and then walking back out. That would be my advice. I actually have been in the Grand Canyon with somebody who had vertigo. I didn't know it till we were about, a quarter mile in. And it took us about 10 hours to go about 3 miles. And he tiptoed along and was quite frightened. And it taught me to ask that question before taking people in: do you have vertigo? Mm. It's quite a lovely place to visit, even if you just walk along the rim of Grand Canyon.
I think that's good advice, Maria.
Okay.
Doesn't mean you shouldn't go.
I like that, to walk in a little ways, get your dose, and then you can walk back out, and you've had
yeah.
it. You know, when I'm doing any mule or donkey ride in some great canyon or whatever, I'm nervous about the sure-footedness of the animals. Now, you've been doing this professionally for a long time. It seems very ginger and very fragile, but these beasts of burden, do they ever, like, slip and roll down the mountain and take the tourist with them?
They tend not to take tourists, but they break in these mules for a long time, Rick. And their first job is to carry supplies down to Phantom Ranch, which is at the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
Right.
And so they carry stuff instead of people. And then when they have proved themselves to be very reliable, then they carry people. But you do sometimes see that a pack mule has gone over.
Really?
But no, I would trust them more than most people on their own 2 feet.
Probably better than your own 2 feet, a mule's 4 feet.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. We're sharing observations about one of America's greatest sights, Grand Canyon, with Flagstaff-based writer Margaret Earhart on Travel with Rick Steves. You can read essays on modern life that Margaret writes for Flagstaff Live. It's in the notes to this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Elinda's on the line in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania. Elinda, thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick. I've not hiked in the canyon, but one of the things we did that we particularly enjoyed was at night we were able to get a guide that took us to watch the stars, sitting our feet right by the edge of the canyon and looking up at all the stars, telling us the constellations. And I've never seen so many stars because, you know, you're far away from electric lights. So it was just a wonderful extra experience that I hadn't known about ahead of time.
That's great. Looking up instead of down. At night, you can look up. Yes,
right.
That's good.
And, you know, I've not rafted the Grand Canyon, but I've rafted rivers in beautiful places in Idaho. And in the middle of the night, when I go down to the river, I can look down and see the constellations. It's one of the most magic experiences to see the constellations reflected in the water when you're in the middle of nowhere, when it's so dark out. It's just a beautiful thing.
I have to say, too, Rick, speaking of the river, when you look up from the river at night, you're often in a very tight canyon or a narrow canyon, narrower than most, because it's a mile below the rim.
Right.
So you just get a slim band of sky often, and that changes. As you wake up in the night, you can see, the Big Dipper has moved. There's Cassiopeia now. It's wonderful. It's like watching a very small screen instead of the large one.
Oh, that's a fun angle on constellation watching. And Harry's on the line in Springfield, Virginia. Harry, thanks for your call.
Yes. Hi, Rick.
Hey,
hi,
there.
Margaret.
Hi.
I've done 5 rim-to-rim, one-day hikes across the canyon, and that's a wonderful adventure and a wonderful way to spend a day. It's a long day, but very enjoyable.
So rim-to-rim, that means down 1 mile and then over and then up 1 mile, is that right?
Yes, in one day. I've done 5 of those.
How do you cross the river?
There are 2 bridges there, just a little south of the Phantom Ranch. One for the South Kaibab Trail and one for the Bright Angel Trail.
Yeah. Margaret, what's your take on going rim to rim?
I admire people who do it, and I think they're somewhat crazy. It's 21 miles one way. I do know people who go rim to rim to rim, and that's really crazy.
Wow.
But I'll tell you what, you know, it's such a beautiful place to hike. I have never done a rim to rim in one day. I get distracted by things on the ground, like, well, things to look at. But I think many people do, and I really do admire their fortitude in doing so.
Harry, thanks for your comment there.
Okay, Rick, good talking with you.
You bet. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Margaret Earhart, and her novel is The Butterflies of Grand Canyon. It's a mystery novel set in the Grand Canyon area about a woman visiting the canyon, becoming enthralled with its natural majesty, and with an attractive local ranger. And Margaret, I gather there's a certain amount of autobiography in this book.
There's quite a bit of autobiography in every book, no matter who we're portraying. There's probably a little less than usual in this one, except, of course, for the fact that here I am, somebody who's in love with the Grand Canyon, and I hope that people can feel that through my characters.
And in love with the big grandeur of nature and in love with the micro nature. You wrote this: rocks, bugs, plants, each tells a story and their stories intertwine. Catch a butterfly and you've caught a world. You've caught a story. What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, I mean, that butterfly, depending on the species, can tell you so many things. It can tell you that the climate is changing and warming or not. It can tell you stuff about the flora. The butterflies, of course, mm-hmm. tell lots of stories about what plants are there because they pollinate and nectar on certain plants. As corridors of wildlife move across the land, there are corridors for butterflies and bugs as well. We learn about all kinds of things, from finding a certain species in a place we've never found it before. Things like the symbiotic relationship between plants and animals is always something that teaches us about specifically climate. And also we can find fossils of dragonflies that tell us what kind of weather was happening a million years ago, or in many cases, 250 million years ago.
Wow. And the more you bring to that as a keen observer, probably the more you're able to get out of it.
Yeah, I think so. That's one of my philosophies of life, Rick.
Right.
Is bring everything to it and you will reap more.
Margaret, if you're thinking of one quintessential magical moment in the Grand Canyon that we would have if we went there and appreciated the Grand Canyon the way it's impacted you, paint a picture. What would that be?
Well, you've spent two nights in the Grand Canyon already as a hiker, and on the third day, your guide says, let's go somewhere we've never been before. And you clamber around a beautiful waterfall, thinking, why are we going above this fall? I'm perfectly content to stay below it. And you find yourselves, all of you, there's a small group, let's say, in a meadow that doesn't even have a trail in it because it's so seldom been explored. And the farther you walk in this meadow, the more waterfalls you see, and you climb up above each one. And finally, you can go no farther, but you have laid eyes on more water that day than you ever thought existed in the world. Then you go home, back to your tent, and after dinner, you lie out and look at the stars, and that's what I feel is a good day in the Grand Canyon.
Wow. You inspire us and you challenge us to appreciate the many dimensions of Grand Canyon. Margaret Earhart, thanks so much for joining us.
But thank you. It's been my pleasure, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Casmara Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling uploads the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. And our theme music is by Jerry Frank. We had studio help this week from OPB in Portland and KNAU Flagstaff. There's more at ricksteves.com/radio.